Hello and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is Darius Arya, an archaeologist, professor, and host of several documentaries for channels like the Discovery Channel, History Channel, Nat Geo, PBS, and more. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Getty Museum here in Los Angeles, which we talk about what he's doing there. And he's lived in Rome for the last 20 years with his family. And if you're considering visiting Rome or Italy in general, we talk a lot about cities to go to, those quote unquote tourist traps in those cities, and more. I love learning about history, so therefore I love chatting with him. He knows a lot about ancient Rome. So enjoy. I was thinking about this with you coming in.
Yeah.
I was talking to my coworker downstairs. Obviously, the United States has existed, you know, in like 2 seconds compared to where Italy is today.
Yeah, people living there.
Yeah. So when we learned American history, it seemed like a lot to me.
Oh yeah, it's overwhelming. I remember learning it too.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming.
I mean, because you learn
so
about
many facts and so many
first
people
coming here and yada yada. And then, do Italian children? Like how, I mean, there's a lot of layers Rome specifically.
They get so much history. It's unbelievable what my kids are learning. It is ridiculous.
Really?
Yeah. And it's not an exaggeration to say that when they're in high school, and this is 5 years for high school, when they come out of high school, it's pretty much an undergraduate degree. It's that serious. Yeah. And they fail people in high school. They fail them all the time. This is a different mentality over there. And I didn't grow up in it. And it's really amazing to see.
They fail, meaning like you get held back more often.
Yeah. All the time.
Wow.
Or you'll have like, you know, I don't know, 11 subjects and you might fail or, you know, be marginalized on three. Then you got to take summer school and you got to come back in September when school starts. If you don't pass that test, whoop, start over.
Wow.
So imagine the kids like sweating, like, oh my God, I can fail and I won't know until September. Your whole summer's ruined.
I mean, you got to go way in depth on
That's
certain
amazing.
Things. Because like, even just if you go to, I couldn't even begin to catch up on the amount of history that you know, and apparently your daughters know.
Yeah,
but if you go to like the Wikipedia page for history of Italy, it's so long and so organized that it amazes me that anyone even put it together in the first place. Because it's like there's like the something before the empire, the republic.
Oh yeah, yeah. But
right?
Even before the republic, you've got the regal period. Before the regal period, you have like this proto-history, the prehistory. And then you have all the indigenous people living all over Italy. But I'll tell you what, here's the incredible thing. Living in Italy, what blows me away is that they only have a modern government as of 1870. So before 1870, there were all these city-states and some kingdoms. And of course, there was the papacy. The Pope had his own territory. So they're not a unified country until 1870. And then, of course, that monarchy that they had, it fails already when Mussolini's coming into power. It still exists, but it fails.
Right.
And then Mussolini's out of power, but the Nazis step in. Then in come the Allies and liberate Rome and yada, yada. And then there's a reconstruction of the government. There's an interim government. And then finally there's a republic.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then that republic, you know, on average it fails. The coalition governments fail every 2 years. So it's a really young country compared to the United States. I mean, we're so old and stable. We've got this great constitution.
Yeah.
So that's the difference then. It's like the nationality, the view is so different.
That's with interesting.
All that history,
I wouldn't
with
have even
history.
Thought of that.
It's almost like really your first a Roman or a Neapolitan or from Milan more so than you're Italian.
Got it.
I mean, you are Italian and now you're part of the EU, but it's a very different kind of feeling for the average person, the average citizen living there.
Okay, got it. So if you are born and raised in Milan, you would maybe first say, oh, I'm Milano.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, you're meeting another town, like, where are you from? Like, Milan.
Okay.
Now, a guy like me, it's all messed up because it's like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from America. But where? I'm like, well, I lived in like 5 different states. But where were you born? I was born in Buffalo, but I lived there a year. But to them, it's like, you're from Buffalo.
Yeah.
Because that's where you're born.
Yeah, case
because
closed.
People don't move around. So I just go there for now and I just go, I'm from Texas. Because that's where I last lived for graduate school when I got my PhD. And then they go, ah, Texas. You know, they suddenly have this image that I lived on a ranch, you know, and I had horses.
Yeah, is that the perspective of Texas?
Yeah, it's hilarious, yeah. I own, you know, oil rigs and I don't know.
Right. You wear cowboy boots.
Mm-hmm.
So you lived in 5 different states here. I was trying to figure out where you were from. I couldn't put my finger on it.
Yeah.
So you were born in Buffalo.
I was born in Buffalo, grew up in Huntington, West Virginia.
Okay.
Then I went to high school in Exeter, New Hampshire.
I read that.
Yeah.
And that's like a boarding school.
Boarding school,
kind of,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okay. But co-ed or all boys?
Definitely co-ed.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Great, great education. I think it's something like 1781 as a school. And I actually started studying Latin when I was in West Virginia. We had a great Latin teacher, very inspiring. But then I continued with Latin and Greek at Exeter. Then I continued at Phillips. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. So I was in Philadelphia. Continued studying classics. Studied in Rome for a semester, which is a great opportunity. And that's where it really hit me that this is something I could do. Not right. just the languages, but being immersed in that ancient culture. I mean, you literally can live in that sphere of antiquity on a daily basis. I thought it was really exciting. Not just seeing the, you know, the Colosseum and everything.
Was that the first time that you remember comprehending how many people and lives and like stories had happened before in that space? Like, is that the first time you remember comprehending just how old everything was there?
Now, I really liked the old stuff as a kid, and I'm like Iranian American. So, you know, there's some of that culture that I have. I mean, I didn't grow up in California, so didn't get that. I don't know Farsi or anything. So I kind of lost that, but I was always interested in the old stuff. Mm. So I remember going to the Smithsonian as a kid, and that's what it's like going to museums. Just, I always gravitated toward the ancient civilizations. It was just fascinating. So probably was first the Smithsonian. Then it was like, do you want to study French or do you want to study Latin? I'm like, I've got to study Latin because, yeah. And then I just continued in that vein. And it brought me to Rome. I mean, a lot of people eventually come to Rome for various reasons, but it just really stuck with me. So then I thought, well, I'm going to do what I do, get a PhD and so forth. That's what you did back in the day. But I want to make sure I do a lot of study in Rome. And then finally it was like, well, why don't I just live in Rome?
Right.
So that's
foolhardy. When did the digging come into play?
So digging, I mean, it's a big part of archaeology is, big part of, you know, studying archaeology is doing digs. So I'm not a lot of people in the field, you know, they'll be doing things theoretically. And I believe in just, you know, doing the dig.
Yeah.
So I've been involved. I've led a lot of digs and had great university partners. Like we did one with Stanford and Oxford. And I have a nonprofit. So the nonprofit's called the American Institute for Roman Culture. And that's chugging along here since 2002 and do all kinds of great collaborations. A lot of educational content that's online that we do. We're present in social media and so forth.
Yeah, actually, so that's I all. Wrote down, you guys started a platform called Ancient Rome Live, right?
Yeah, which is right when the live streaming took off. So that's been building. And so I got recognized at one point with a Shorty Award for live streaming and stuff. But
that's cool.
Yeah, that continues.
Yeah.
And that's just a great way because it's raw. It's just, you know, here we are at X. So it's like having the knowledge, but then being, you know, willing to convey that, take the time out to talk to people just on the spot. And that's a great way to engage people about history. I mean, that's, I think what it comes down to is, people love history in many different ways in their lives as students or, you know, later on they're doing something else, but they turn on the TV and they're seeing one of those history programs. Mm-hmm. But then how do you further that? How do you continue that? How do you, you know, stimulate it?
Yeah.
And I
make
think
people like kind of care more about it.
Big thing in the end of it is that the heritage that you see in a museum, right, that has to be cared for. The stuff that you see outside, that really has to be cared for, right? Because it's just being, once you've excavated it, it's exposed, and then it's going to deteriorate. So everything that we see and appreciate and love, somebody's had a hand at ensuring that it's still there. Otherwise, it falls over. You know, or in the case of war, you know, we read about, you know, Palmyra being destroyed, or we read about the fire in the museum, the National Museum in Brazil, and it's like a collective loss. We've all lost something. Mm-hmm. Even if you haven't been to Brazil or you don't know Brazilian history, it's just like, that was a national collection. That's like the Smithsonian burning down. I mean, that would be just a tragedy.
Right.
So, and that helps us then, allows us to talk about these issues. How do we preserve history? You know, how do we, you know, continue to engage it and not be at that point where, oh, now it's gone. We can't get it back.
Yeah. Has there been anything that have been lost to just people being irresponsible? In, like, let's say Rome specifically.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. I mean, they have so much stuff. And then you look at how they organize to take care of it. I mean, there's just, it's overwhelming. So they, at this point in the past several years now, they've been much more engaged in finding private sponsorship. And it can be universities. It can be, you know, famously it was Todd's at the Colosseum. And they had to change laws and they had to be able to accommodate these things. But you think about it in America, we sponsor everything.
Right.
And that's just part of our... I mean, both, it's kind of what we expect, but also it's part of the DNA that you see people giving back. I mean, where else in the world are all these billionaires giving away so much of their wealth? I mean, it's just, again, part of our DNA. I mean, you can be remembered, but you can also make these contributions. You,
right.
You know, it's just, it's a huge, huge part of our society. It doesn't exist in all the societies. Like, Italy doesn't have a huge tradition of billionaires, the wealthy really giving, but now the people from the fashion industry, they've seen a connection and they've started to do it. So the Gucci's and the Bulgari's and the Todd's, you know, for the Colosseum. And that's a great step, I think, you
in
know.
Helping.
Yeah, because I mean, everyone's a stakeholder, you know, like children going to museums, they're participants, school teachers, university professors, and so forth. So I'm actually here right now because I have a fellowship at the Getty. So the Getty is one of these very important protagonists in the world. I mean, the work that they do is amazing. So they've got the collection, they've got the museum, but they also have Getty Conservation Institute, which does projects all over the world. And so that's how I came in contact with them because I'm in Rome.
Yeah, see, I didn't even know that that part existed at the Getty Museum.
Oh, yeah, it's phenomenal. I mean, actually, they have great didactics. You can go right up on the tram and off on the left, the East Building is where, like, I have a little, you know, my study space, and they have libraries open to the public, and they have all kinds of didactics about what they do. So it's a phenomenal part of the overall, you know, Getty Trust. And then there's the, you know, the Malibu Getty and so forth. So there are different kinds of, there's conservation work going on to preserve what's in their collection. There's conservation work down at the, in Santa Monica. And then there's the projects they have all over the world. And I was actually in leading one of the seminars from the Rome side for the group for restorers.
Today?
No, pardon me?
Like today you were?
No, this summer,
Oh, okay.
This summer.
Gotcha.
Like the other day.
Yeah,
in May.
The other day,
in
recently.
Yeah.
So what's like your day-to-day like while you're here?
Oh, God. It's amazing because I'm here for like 2.5 months and I feel like the clock is ticking.
Really? No, like enough time?
Well, I have my own research project that I want to do, and pretty much it's how do you bridge all this great audience and participation in social media to the specifics of the conservators and the institutions and so forth. So I'm kind of in the middle as a bridge, you know, gapper, let's say. You know, I have TV shows. I have a show on PBS. It's called Ancient Invisible Cities. It just came out last month that you can see, or, you know, all the social media stuff that I do. So I'm in a pretty good position because I understand what they do in conservation work, even though I'm not a conservator. And then I'm the archaeologist who's kind of like the destroyer, you know,
because
archaeologists reveal and then the stuff deteriorates. So I'm kind of in the midst of that. And I'd rather be, I think it's a good space to be in nowadays, is to really push the preservation side.
Do you feel like people in the conservation space or that field have been kind of slow to take on some of this new media, live streaming, or like, do you think that that's something that people are slow to?
I think maybe if you look at it and say age wise, I think the younger ones that are coming up and then finishing the degrees and so forth, they're going to be more adept at it. They've already been doing
it's
it.
Like a natural thing.
It becomes a natural thing. But as a field and so forth, well, I mean, it's not been part of the DNA of the culture. They're doing this work. And it's, you know, it has its own ecosystem. So it's not been the one that says, hey, and now let's disseminate this to the world, because the conservator works with the curator and the curator has the show and the show that then presents the works of art. Mm-hmm. They'll also put in like, we did this conservation work, we did this, and this is what the conservator did and so forth. But I think it's becoming much more visible. It's becoming much more frequent that like in Rome, I'll be in a museum like teaching my students something, and then there's a little fenced off area and you see the conservator just sitting there cleaning. A sarcophagus. And that, I think that's the way these things become much more tangible, that you don't take it away and put it in the back room and do it. You can just oftentimes do it right in front of, you know, wherever.
Yeah.
And I think the younger generation, this younger generation that, say, really cares about the planet and really wants to be responsible, and like my little, you know, kids are, we're not using any plastic straws anymore and so forth, all that stuff, which is great. I think they will fully embrace these kinds of ideas more so than possibly the older, you know, generation. So I think it's going to be much more in their DNA as they're coming up. Even in fields of archaeology, I think they're going to be much more in tune to the importance of the conservation side. I think there's a shift, which is great.
Yeah, and like anything, if it's out of sight, out of mind, you don't even think about it.
Yep.
So if it's in your face, it's like, oh yeah, they do that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, they have to, I mean, be really careful with a lot of this stuff.
And so like I have my nonprofit and so forth, but we can be pretty dynamic, and we can, you know, pair up with these organizations, these museums or whatever. In Italy, we do it all the time. and work with, you know, Roma Tourism or the museums and so forth, that, to talk about certain ideas where they trust us enough to do takeovers. And I can take over these platforms and talk about these things.
Oh, right, like take over their Instagram.
Yeah, I'm not going to like train wreck it and suddenly go off on some unrelated. Yeah, I can be professional. I am professional about this stuff because I really, really care about it. But you need, I think you need more of that conversation. So maybe some people in the field, you know, I don't really see how that's really going to do anything. That could be the case to some people. But I think overwhelmingly the majority would say, and I'm getting this much more from colleagues, is that, yeah, we want to have some of that, whatever you want to call it, market share. We want to reach out to the people because we can have a profound effect.
Totally.
And there's just so much to do because, you know, everything is, as it's exposed, it's going to deteriorate. So you can slow the deterioration, or you can even stop it if you, you know, do certain things, you know, put it under a shelter or put it inside a museum and whatnot. But living in Rome, I just, every day going by all this stuff, I would say like, that's in dire shape. When that, you know,
I'm sure you're like hyper aware of it.
But Rome is doing really well. I think right now there's a crisis in the sense that the new mayor and the administration and so forth doesn't have the, I don't want to say the wherewithal or the funding, but basically Rome is looking a little more rough around the edges right now. It's a little more garbage, a little more this, a little more seagulls flapping around, scrounging. But the city, I mean, in terms of the institutions and the museums and stuff, I think more things are open and there's more options and they're, you know, embracing uses of new technology. So I think there are obviously a lot of positives going on right now in Rome and Italy in general. I mean, I don't know, Allison, everyone I talk to talks about Sicily. I mean, I was there 5 times in the past 3 months, but now like so many people are talking about Sicily. So I think
Sicily is trending.
I guess Sicily is trending. I think so.
Is Matera near Sicily?
Matera is in Basilicata, and it's toward like the bottom of the boot.
Like the heel.
Yeah. And I actually did a show in Italian in Matera. So I have a TV show in Italian as well, and that was season 1. So I've got to know the place really well. It is actually the cultural city, the cultural capital of Europe in 2019.
Oh.
So I think that's like...
How does it get that designation? Like,
well, it's just like anything. There's going to be lobbying. There's going to be like, just like you say, I want to be the host city for the Olympics. Mm. So there's always this momentum going forward to the EU saying, who's going to be our standout city?
Yeah.
Big or small, you know?
Stand up, people.
And so these guys really did a great job and obviously did a lot of conservation work and preserved more and so gave some access and so on and so forth. And then bam, here they are, 2019. So I did the show, I guess that was in 2016. You can find it on YouTube and practice your Italian. Trying to get it in English. But anyways, the nice thing about this city is it is unique. It is so unique. And if you watch Wonder Woman, it appears a couple of recent movies.
Oh, really?
But I think Mel Gibson was the guy who more recently put it into people's ideas with, what's it called, Passion of Christ? Remember that one that he did?
Oh, was that in?
When he made $1 billion. So if you want a city that looks like Jerusalem used to look in antiquity, you just go to Matera.
Did I read that they used to live in, a lot of people lived in caves?
Yes.
And then they were kicked out because
it just got
the city thought it wasn't
it was getting
healthy.
It was pretty bad at a certain point.
Okay.
So basically the city then gets entirely abandoned. I think it's like the 50s or something or 60s. Like they call it like this big embarrassment. Anyways. They brought it all back. They brought in infrastructure. They brought in, you know, modern sewage systems and so on and so forth. And it's really nice. I mean, you can stay in the grottos and caves and these, you know, hotels that are there and so forth. And it really is unique. I mean, you go there and then you don't have the car. You just walk.
Yeah,
and
that's awesome.
Yeah, and it's all these caves, you know, there are hundreds of churches that they made out of these caves. So basically you get this period of persecution in the eastern part of the empire, and a lot of people in these waves came over. And this is like in the, I think, by the 9th century. So anyways, and they settled down in southern Italy and so forth. And
found a home in the caves.
Yeah. A lot of them are monastic, living a hermit life, and that's what you did. And then you had it decorated, so the frescoes are just amazing. Yeah.
So they spruced up their caves. And
yes.
That's cool. So if you go there now, how many people live there? Is it a big city?
No, it's tiny. It's
small?
I don't know. I mean, people that actually live in Matera, like the historic center, would be just, I don't know, a couple thousand.
Not big.
Yeah, not big. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But it's overwhelming when you see it. It really is just beautiful.
Interesting. And so you mentioned that a lot of people are talking about Sicily, and you didn't notice that in like years past. It's a recent thing.
No, I've been going to Sicily since, I mean, the first time I went to Sicily, it was 92. And then I just, I mean, personally, I mean, most of it's just work and teaching and stuff like that. But now I've seen much more because I was doing some work there recently. It's definitely picking up momentum. Palermo is just, they've just made a huge section of the historic center pedestrian only. Mm. And that just, whoop, everyone just shows up. I mean, it's just amazing. So whereas before, like 1992 is famous because there's a famous prosecutor of the mafia who he and his motorcade were blown up on the highway. A huge section of highway was blown up. And from that point on, the government responded by sending in the military to occupy Palermo. So that was like a low point in 1992 when I visited as a student. But then just move forward. I mean, like, it's just nothing like that anymore. They kind of broke the back of
mafia. Do you remember that?
Mafia.
Like the military being on the streets
and
stuff?
When we were there, yeah, they were like, I did this study project and I was an undergrad. And so we went to all these great archaeological sites all over Sicily. But for Palermo, they said, okay, we're only going to take you into the museum. And that's it. No funny business. Nobody sneak out. I mean, they gave us like, you know.
Yeah.
So we were like, okay.
All right, fine.
Police, military, you know, everywhere. But it's just incredible how it's bounced back. It's fantastic. It's an easy flight. It's like a 45-minute flight from Rome.
Gotcha.
Easy.
Yeah.
And it's just a great island to discover. I won't even get into the food.
Yeah.
It's just...
Oh. It's great.
Great. Cheap, too.
You know,
very inexpensive
funny.
Compared to Rome.
My mom and I went to Rome, and she, for whatever reason, can't eat out at restaurants here in the United States. Like, I don't know if it's just, like, more stuff, like, more preservatives in food at restaurants typically or something. She just, like, notoriously always gets a stomachache. Always.
Okay.
And the whole time we were in Rome, like, she was fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything... Okay, so then the Italians will say, like, if you look at the entire Italian cuisine, they'll say, Romans, their food is really salty. Which is pretty much true compared to other, you know, but the food, it is definitely different. I mean, everything is different from kind of start to finish. So, you know, everyone, we kind of have a farmer's market kind of reality and everything's grown locally.
Right.
So, you know, I go to a market, you know, and I just pick up my fresh produce from a stall that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of touristy stuff, of course, and this and that. And we have grocery stores, you know,
right.
But, you know, there's a reality that exists that is, you know, not artificial or something that's contrived or something that's trendy. It's just the way it always was.
Yeah, way more farm to table, just how...
Normal.
Always.
And then you say, hey, it's November. Let's go out and get some fresh olive oil. Mm. Hey, it's, you know, when my kids can go pick some olives with a friend. Or, you know, hey, let's go out and, you know, go to the wine. Or let's go get, you know, what... And then it's, you know, that's just what you do. I mean, if you want to, it's pretty accessible.
Yeah, and you're probably more aware of, like, what's in season.
Yeah, they're all like, in that sense, they're all inherently food snobs, you know, because, and then you're just the American anyway, so what do you know?
Yeah.
But
going to McDonald's to get the Italian breadsticks.
Actually, amazingly, yeah, I think the Italians, they do go to McDonald's. I mean, I think it's doing well there. But I never took my kids, and then all of a sudden it was like, she was like, I went to a play date and we did, and then the parents took us to McDonald's. I was like, you're never going out with them again.
What is your daughter's favorite food?
Okay.
Like, what's their most requested?
The older one is now vegan.
Oh.
So, and she's 16 and she's vegetarian for a while. Now she's vegan. She also does mixed martial arts. So it's a good balance for being vegan. So she's, you know, she's doing well. But obviously she loves, I mean, you can definitely survive very nicely as a vegetarian or vegan in Italy. There's tons of stuff for them. And then on the flip side, the little one, she's 10, but she's pretty much the carnivore of the family. We're trying to, human beings are omnivores, you know, you can, so you have a little tougher time getting her the, you know,
the veggies.
Eat those veggies.
Yeah.
But no, she loves, so it's like, if you're on a stranded island, what would you eat? And she's like, oh, that's easy. Sausage. Okay. If you could have a second product on the island forever, what would it be? She's like, salami.
Of course, duh.
Duh. So we're working on that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Gotcha. Nah,
but, you know, we have all kinds of, the standard things that you grow up with are things like, you know, artichokes.
Yeah.
So that's not, it's not easy for kids to get into all those sort of artichokes. It's like one of the many things that we have. A lot of the lettuces are more bitter and so forth. So.
Gotcha. Where's your wife from?
So she's from Philadelphia.
Oh, is that where you guys met? When you were...
Yeah, we both went to Penn together.
Gotcha.
But also, she is Italian. Her mom is from Rome, left after the war. So
wow.
It's a nice nice way of, in a sense, for her coming back.
Yeah.
You know, even though people look at the two of us and they usually pick me as being the Italian.
Really?
I mean, she look. I mean, what does an Italian look like? Italians are. Yeah. They can have red hair. They can have blonde hair. They can have green eyes. They can be, you know, any, you know, color stripe, whatever. But I just like, oh yeah, he's the Sicilian. I'm like, I'm not Sicilian.
Oh, right. Because Northern Italians are a little more fair complexion, right?
Well, no, it's all mixed because, see, the Normans, you know where Normandy is in France. When the uh-huh. Normans come and invade Sicily in 1084 to kick out the Arab occupation, which had existed for 200 years prior, well, they all come in and move in. And what are they? They got red hair. They got blonde hair. So you meet tons of Sicilians that are descendants of the Normans.
Wow.
And they're all like, you mean all these red-haired, you know, blonde, yeah. I was just listening tall,
to I was just listening to the comedian Andrew Santino. He went back to visit family in like Sicily, maybe, and he has red hair. And they're always like, "Oh, Santino!" And but they're like, whenever he visits, they're disappointed because his last name is Santino. He doesn't speak Italian, and he has red hair. That's fine. So, do you guys as a family come back here often?
Oh yeah, we were here this summer. We actually passed through L.A. and. We had some friends that, you know, took us to a specific trendy, you know, vegan restaurant. Can't remember.
Oh, yeah. It's easy to be a vegan here.
I put this way. I shelled out more money for that restaurant than any restaurant I ever paid for in L.A. Yeah. And I paid for some expensive. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
We can't afford this habit. No, we went to the little one. We were walking down Sunset and Brad Pitt, you know, they blocked up the street and they're filming, you know, that new movie. So we caught a glimpse. You know, they're driving by in some cars.
Oh, yeah, it's about the Manson murders.
Yeah, exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
So we saw a little bit of that, and they thought that was cool. And we saw the stars, and then all of a sudden the little one is really hot. So she's like, "I've never been to a wax museum." So we went to the wax museum.
How was that?
That was actually a lot of fun. A lot of selfies.
I haven't been to any of them because I know there was one in London. I almost went to
Did. And Madame Tussauds. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that and then, fun. But so anyways, I haven't been to one. I'm always curious.
It's all updated, so it's like, you know, it's like Marvel comic, you know, the actors, and it's
right,
you know, movie stars and today
it's like Meghan Markle's in there now with Prince Harry.
Yeah. And then they threw in some, I mean, there's obviously a lot of old people, you know, like maybe some classic person. My kids were like, "Hey, that's you know, Clark Gable." And like, I don't know who that is.
We don't care. Yeah.
I'm like, "Oh, that's you know, that's, you know," I'm like, "Oh, that's that old movie. You made us watch that old Indiana Jones movie. We don't like that." You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
So it's a
yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. You feel your age there.
Do you feel like when you go to a new city in general, when you're traveling, you have a certain mentality to it? Like, oh, I want to avoid some of the more hot spots. Or do you go to them, but you sort of like try to, you know, putz around and go down some side streets? And like, what's sort of like your mentality when you go to, when you're traveling and visiting a city?
Yeah, so if I don't really have an agenda. See, if I go to a place and there's something ancient.
Right.
They have to tear me away.
Yeah.
So and if I'm doing something for work, so you know, some social media project or something, like with Croatia, one time we were in Japan. So then you've got different things you have to do and you feel like, I want me time. I want to just explore this on my own, but you've got some sort of schedule and that's tough.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, yeah, I suppose it could kind of be like, oh, I'd like to see this. I'd like to do that. But I don't really feel... You know, like I know when so many people I've seen or known that they come to Rome and I've clearly got to do this. Well, you don't really want to do that. You know, if you go to the Vatican, it's like, oh, unless you go super early or go at night on a Friday. So sometimes, I mean, I would just as soon probably for myself just avoid it.
Right.
You know, then you got your kids. If you're with your kids and you're thinking about, you can't really push it too much, you know, knowing your kids and so forth. And so, you do want to make sure they see this or that or something that you did. So yeah, I'm pretty easy. Obviously something good to eat.
Yeah.
Kind of, my wife's into street food. So, you know, maybe, and then mixing it up and going to see a contemporary art exhibition. Like, and I'm an archaeologist. What do I know about that? But then I'm with someone who was in the field. She's a journalist, you know, my wife and so forth. So it's really good to mix that up. So
right.
It's not just unilaterally like on one thing that I'm really passionate about and I love that, you know, so I try to mix it up. So even if I'm by myself in a place, I'll still now, it's kind of ingrained in me. Don't just do that one thing. Get out of your comfort zone. Do things that you don't really know something about and you get a lot out of that.
Yeah. Are there any cities that you haven't been to that you're sort of like, oh, I got to get there ASAP?
Yep. Tons. Yeah, but I mean...
Like what's like top three?
Oh. Well, I mean, I should plan this trip to, I've got some colleagues now because of the conservation work and so forth. I'd like to go to Algeria, which might not be on the top of a lot of people's lists, but there are some amazing Roman sites that I'm kind of dying to go see. So I think I'm trying to organize this thing now with some colleagues, some other colleagues in Cyprus. I'd like to go back to Lebanon. I did a show once on History Channel. I've been back there. So, I mean, there's just so many, you know, great places.
God, the Romans just touched everywhere.
Yeah, but the thing is, but not just that, but not just the Roman stuff. It's like, these are just incredible, you know, civilizations. And then from Rome, because that's my base, it's like a 2-hour flight to anywhere.
Of course, yeah.
So in that sense, it's really easy to, like to plan a family trip down the Nile, you know.
Would they be down? Would your wife be down?
Let's go.
Let's do it. Here we are, kids, on the Nile.
Exactly. It's all doable.
Do people do that? Mm-hmm. Like organized trips down the Nile?
Absolutely.
Oh.
Absolutely.
I wonder how the mosquitoes are.
No, I just go, well, it depends on what time of year you go.
Get a bug
December's good.
Yeah. Are there any, so I didn't realize how much of a huge hub Rome is for archaeology, and now that I'm more aware of it, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Are there any other, like, what other destinations in the world are big places to go for an archaeologist? Like,
well, I mean, the reason why Rome is so big, too, is that for hundreds and hundreds of years, people have come and done studies. So there's, like, the German Academy, the British, the American Academy. I was a fellow there, too, back in the day. It's going to be 125 years old, and that's the young one. But the other ones, imagine for 100, you know, as old as America is, people have been going to Rome on some level in studying. So it just has become this massive archaeological hub. There's another big one in Istanbul. There's another big one in Amman. There's another big one in Athens and so forth. So
gotcha. Machu Picchu, maybe? I want to go there.
I mean, maybe it's Cusco. I don't know. That's another place on my list. I'm trying to.
Oh, you haven't been there?
No, I'm trying to do it with the show, so we'll see.
That'd be sweet. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that's part of the perks of the job, but we'll see.
We were talking about this earlier. Are there any like conspiracy theories that drive archaeologists crazy? Because Patrick over here brought up the like riddle of the Sphinx.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
And how like it's generally accepted that that was built around the time of the pyramids, right?
Right. And then there's
there's like discrepancies on the size of the head, so people think. Maybe the general acceptance of timing is wrong.
Well, actually, if you watch the Cairo episode on Ancient Invisible Cities, we talk about that.
Do you?
And I am right there, standing right in front of the damn thing. So check it out.
Gotcha. But are there any other things like that?
Nah, I mean, all these aliens and all this sort of stuff. I mean, all the shows that I do, I'm a legitimate, you know, archaeologist and so forth. So I would stay away from space aliens and stuff like that. I mean, it's incredible what the human mind is able to achieve. And it's incredible that there are coincidences halfway around the world, you know?
Yeah.
And structures can be similar and so on and so forth. But it's, I think it's just really fascinating if we delve into the past and get back to learning what these people were able to achieve, how they failed. I mean, you know, you've got a lot of failures in, you know, why civilizations end. Rome is one of those places where it's fantastically exceptional in that, the city then becomes the hub of a new religion. And then it then becomes the capital of a country.
Right.
So most places that we're reading and studying and digging, they cease to be that great thing or relevant or even occupied. And that's why there are these great, you know, archaeological sites all over the world. So Rome's one of those kind of exceptions. Plus the fact that we know so much about the Romans because of what they read and how that was, you know, preserved over the millennia. I think the main thing for me is it's still relevant to us, and then I want it to connect with people that this has to be preserved.
Right.
You know, digitize it, storytell it, embrace it, you know, make it more, you know, part of the education. I'm just like talking about the Romans. The Romans is the easy sell, and that's the old thing that everybody knows. Everyone studies the Greeks and the Romans, but there are, you know, 100 other civilizations that we need to study and get involved in and see the connectivity between all these different civilizations and how people think across the globe.
Right.
And that's really, really worthwhile.
Do you think that, like...
I'm sounding too educational now.
Well, no, I know what you're saying. I was just thinking, like, I watched the first half of Gladiator a couple nights ago.
Only the first half?
I fell asleep.
It was my buddy Russell Crowe. I know Russell.
Do you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great movie.
He's the man.
I've seen it a while ago, but okay. I was like, I need to get in the zone. But then I fell asleep because I watched it in bed, which is like, you can't do that.
You got to watch that on the big screen. So they did. They had a 20-year celebration of Gladiator.
It's been out for 20 years?
Yeah. I think about that. Anyways, they did a big production with the orchestra and so forth. I mean, live orchestra, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And they did these things in Rome. And so I'd done some, let's say I got involved in preserving a site that was going to be reburied. Anyways, kind of tied to the character in Gladiator. So we were like Twitter buddies.
Yeah.
When we came, we actually met and we hung out and we had a great evening together.
Oh, that's awesome.
Wonderful, wonderful person. He really loves history, really smart guy. And we had a really, really great conversation.
Do you think that's what led him to doing that movie? Because he was already like sort of interested in...
Oh, I never asked him, but I think he definitely, I mean, just talking to him, he's well-read. I mean, he's really immersed in history. So the role that he had, let me tell you, a movie like that, an actor like that, I mean, it just put a huge spike in the interest in classics, in archaeology, just like Indiana Jones.
That was my question. Like, how does that... I feel like that would help.
Absolutely, because you get a visceral sense, except for you who fell asleep, the only person who's ever fallen asleep in Gladiator. But basically, you gotta watch this because it gives me goosebumps because, sure, not everything is accurate like my knowledge or whatever, but it's a movie. It's really Scott. I mean, they just did such a great job to combine. Ultimately, what gives you a graphic sense of... The harsh realities, but in the end, they're people. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what really, I think, connects to people with that movie is that you get a sense these are real people that really went through incredible challenges.
Yeah. And, just straight chaos.
Yeah.
I feel like.
It was a brutal world. I mean, but of course, if you look at the world today, I mean, we can turn on our phones and we can look at the harsh realities around the world. But that gave us a window into a time that, on a certain level, I'm studying the Romans. The Romans were amazing, and this, but I never forget how brutal that world was, and I would never want to live in that world. But then I think that movie's something that gives you some insight into people's beliefs and convictions and just audacity. Yeah. And it's a great movie.
Yeah, I also watched. It hasn't been out for too long. It's on Netflix called Empire Games. Are you familiar with that?
I saw a little bit of that. Yeah, I feel like
you would be interested in watching it because
I should be doing something like that.
Yeah, true.
Netflix, are you listening?
Maybe
I'm going to Amazon, watch out. No.
But one of them was about specifically, after Julius Caesar was assassinated, and it starts there. And it's basically a series about how political rivalries and bloodshed and whatever have House of Cards is today, back then.
I've done shows like that. That's probably why. It's sometimes hard to watch when you've done shows like that and you're kind of like, I did it better. I could do a better job. I don't know. But it also means I know the content. So I'll look at it from a kind of professional academic kind of standpoint and say, okay, that's what's out there. It's good to know.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go talk to Netflix and no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? No, but I'm glad that people are watching that because Netflix needs to make more documentaries.
Definitely.
And everyone does. I mean, this is an important way to get into history and you want to be engaged.
Yeah.
And you want to be entertained.
It really makes you think about something like that. Mm-hmm. It's this period of time that I just, 300 AD or, the year 1400. It's all a long time ago to me.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, but very different times.
Very different. Yeah, yeah. And so like this particular like Empire Games, for example, it's about Caligula.
Oh, I've done like three shows on Caligula. I don't know, one of those
two. Who seems like a real nice guy.
He was a great guy. He was a great guy. Yeah.
Terrible. Yeah. And was maybe, assassinated by
his own Praetorian guard. Yeah, his own guard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So very well loved. But just even learning like specific stories like that, like, Jesus, this has clearly happened 500 million times all over the world. It just puts into perspective, I think, like how long people have been living and breathing and doing stuff and dying and reproducing. And
I mean, it's the same. I mean, what they're doing in Rome is like what we're doing today. I mean, in the sense that we're human beings with the same ambitions. We have, politicians or world leaders or whatever. People push the envelope.
Yeah.
And then it can work or it can fail. And for the Romans, you can see who are they appealing to. So you've got the military, you've got the senators, so you need that kind of governing body.
Right.
you've got your own bodyguard. You better do that one right. You've got your family members. They bump you off and then they can take right over. So they're that close to that ultimate power. And you have the people. Don't disregard the people. And those masses are very, very important. So in the city of Rome, there are more people in the city of Rome than there are military and in the Praetorian Guard. So you've got like a million people. So they're dangerous as well. So right. You have to balance all of that and appeal to and appease. And that's what you see when you look at, the Julius Caesars and the Caligulas. They're dealing with those people even directly in that mega city of Rome, which was like the biggest city of antiquity.
Yeah.
Very, very crowded.
How many people total did the Colosseum hold?
Colosseum... So the Romans had 87,000. We put it around 50.
Oh, okay.
Even higher. But I mean, around 50,000, let's say, is at a minimum. And it's the biggest amphitheater for gladiatorial spectacles. But then down the street is the Circus Maximus. That held 250,000 people because the track was 500 meters long. So imagine all this. And one little section now, for example, they opened, it was an archaeological site excavated in the 30s. Nothing really happened with it, just fenced off. And now it's an archaeological site that you can visit. And they did more excavation and so forth and other good discoveries. So that's the kind of newness about Rome. Is something as old or well-known as Circus Maximus, only like 2 years ago or so, it became an archaeological site open to the public, which I would say maybe not everybody goes there, but it's an awesome experience if you go there because you're going to be in that space and it really covers all the history of the chariot racing, like your Ben-Hur kind of moment. And you're going to be in that space. It's the place.
Yeah.
So it's, and that's nice. It's nice when they open up new places like that and excavations continue.
Totally.
And as well as the preservation work, because I got to keep on going back to the preserving. But yeah.
Preserve.
Which I got to get a good hashtag. Help me find a good hashtag.
You have a hashtag that's, Conversation for Conservation.
That's so long. Yes. I have a C4C conference that I ran a couple years ago. I'd like to bring it back, probably just digitally or, like recordings like this. But because who goes to conferences? That's the whole thing nowadays. Yeah. So you do a conference and 20 people show up and you all know each other and that's it. But if you do that same thing or you format it for this kind of experience, like podcast, we'll probably do it like a podcast, I think you can just hit a lot more people.
Yeah.
And it has more shelf life. I mean, I think it's better, we did some when we recorded it. It gets on our website, romanculture.org, but, it's usually pretty boring looking at three people talking in a conference and somebody takes the mic and asks the question.
Like, talking heads.
Kind of thing. So it's not so dynamic.
Yeah. It's like you have to make it easy to digest.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe I should just do it next time I go back to Rome. And I'll just have it in 5 different archaeological sites. So each person talks with the background that'll make them refer to what they're standing around. That could be a kind of a cool way to do it.
And the more that I know about something, then for sure the more I want to see it.
Okay.
Because then I know what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, whoa, this happened here? That's insane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, they could do so much more. They're going to rehabilitate the site, but there are 4 temples in a pit. Okay, that's what I call them, 4 temples in a pit. But they're one of a handful of sites that are Republican in date. So that's between 509 BC to, let's say, Julius Caesar and Augustus. There will be a test at the end of this podcast. and so basically, right behind these temples was a space where Julius Caesar was meeting with the Senate and he got assassinated. So he should have been meeting with them in the Forum, but it had burned down in a riot.
Uh-huh.
So they're using another Senate hall because there were 2. And so they use this one. He's in it. Boom, he gets killed. So today, you say, where is that space? So part of it is excavated in this archaeological site. And there are lots of cats there, and everyone takes pictures of the cats. So
the cats?
There are all these, cats in this one. It's like a cat sanctuary.
Of course it is.
Of course. But then there's a road. There's a sidewalk, then a road, and then a kind of now a big wide sidewalk where there's a big bus hub where you pick up your buses. I literally live, 100 feet from there. So, and it's like, can't they outline it? Or you can outline the whole building.
Yeah.
You can get people. There's so many cool ways that people have indicated in other cities where there previously
happened.
Yeah. Or at least there were an outline of the something. But in Rome,
I found that Germany.
My God, you should go do that.
Interesting. I was going to say, I found that Germany did a lot of that post-World War II in like Berlin and Munich.
Yeah.
Like
they also bulldozed a lot of stuff. Like there are condos where Hitler's bunker was, but anyways.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's like an apartment complex.
They didn't
want to keep it
because they didn't want to have that. That's sometimes that's the kind of thing where you say, oh, they didn't want to have a place for people to go, right?
Yeah.
Like neo-Nazis or whatever. So for Rome, the reason why that building I mean, we know where it is, but the reason why it didn't really become anything after Julius Caesar's assassination was they kind of closed it up, and then they put in huge public lavatories because they, you know, bathrooms.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to have a place where people that were sympathetic with, killing the tyrant, you know, they don't want to have a place where people can kind of gather or make it some sort of a shrine. So they just basically eliminated it. And that's why there's not really a big, one of the main reasons why there's not a big building to go and see.
Wow, but even so just, today.
Even today. But we know it's there, and there's some parts of it, so I'd probably make a bigger deal if
I were, like, a little marker or
nothing.
Something?
You think nothing. Nothing.
You just know.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah.
Not, I'm sure any tour guide or whatever, anyone knows, but it's like, it's kind of want to maybe celebrate that a little bit more, especially if I were, like, in charge of Roma tourism. Like, I've done some things with Roma tourism. It's like, I mean, it's not so easy to be in charge and say, just do this, but I personally would, celebrate that kind of, because I mean, Rome is so fantastic because you can literally say in so many cases, it happened here. And I think that really grabs people. Mm-hmm. It's not like it happened somewhere around, it happened right there.
Right here.
And then you go to the forum, you can say, let me give you a list of what happened in the forum. You know, these gladiatorial games, these eulogies were pronounced, right? This is where Julius Caesar, right? And he was ended up being cremated. I mean, all these things are happening in specific places and we know them.
Yeah.
And that's also what, for me, makes the city, living in the city, compelling.
Right.
And it's a contemporary city, you know? We have everything that you have here. What and a lot of cars, too.
How would you describe, like, 2018 culture in Rome? Just for, you know, like, what are, like, is there any unexpected things? Like, is there, like, a great music scene or...
Well, I mean, there's definitely the food scenes, I'd say definitely at this point, in many ways, picked up. I mean, you've got the mass tourism, which is weighing down heavily. So they're, I mean, you see all these local artisans or whatever. Next thing you know, it's like a trinket shop or it's a, baguette. Yeah. So that kind of stuff comes in. We all go, we don't want that. But I mean, there's mass tourism. So, I mean, it's, you know, you the city could deal with it in certain kinds of ways, you know, kind of preserve livelihoods or whatever. But I think that definitely on a higher level, a lot of the food is getting... you know, quite good. And I'm lucky my wife's, again, a journalist, and she writes about this stuff. So I've experienced a lot of, like, some of the finest. But there's also just great little local places, you know, that I would never tell you because I don't want you to show
people
up there.
Know, yeah.
Yeah, I got like a local wine bar and they're like, hey, don't tell anyone about this place. Don't take any pictures. And he's like, yeah, we'll make more money, but it's going to ruin everything.
Right.
I'm like, yeah. And that's what happens now. The crushing weight of tourism is having an impact. You know, before we had no big American chains, and then one day, we got a Gap store.
Oh, no.
And then one day, we got a... Well, we don't have a Starbucks yet, but, you know, Timberland...
No Starbucks?
We had the first Starbucks is in Milan. I'm sure we'll get a Starbucks eventually. We're supposed to get one, but... But, I mean, you know how many coffee bars we have in Rome?
Yeah.
And you know how good our coffee is and how much... You know, around the world... I know there's great coffee around the world, but do not mess with Italian coffee. Just
right.
Do not... So if there's going to be Starbucks, then my 16-year-old will go with her friends and she'll get a Frappuccino or something. Because that's what she'll do, and she'll have free Wi-Fi, and she'll like it.
Right.
So, or some tourist is like, I really miss Starbucks. Go get Starbucks. But seriously, our coffee is serious.
So you said that there's a crushing. I was just explaining to my husband Americano because he ordered it.
Oh, cafe Americano. Yeah.
Si.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can get. I mean, you get it. Sometimes, you know, because I don't actually have any American coffee maker thing at home. I had one years ago and it broke, and then my wife's like, haha, you know. And I was like, I'll get another one. And that's,
cut all ties.
And I never got another one. Actually, I have one in my apartment while I'm here. And I'm like, oh, look at that American coffee maker. But I should have brought my mocha. You know, I should have brought my Italian one with me. I guess I could just buy one.
Right.
But anyways, you get used to habits and stuff.
Of course.
But anyways, Cafe Americano, can get it, but... Yeah,
I lived in.
Let's get that double espresso.
When I lived in England and for a while, and I came back, and I was like, I don't understand why none of you have an electric kettle. And, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, geez.
So I feel that.
Oh god, and then I get mixed up, but it's like my Australian friends will have like Vegemite, and and the Brits have the Marmite.
The Marmite, yeah.
Good god, what is that stuff? So we all have. We have peanut butter. I will admit, I did my online shopping when I got here.
Peanut butter is hard to come by.
Yeah, you can get. It's Dutch. It's easy to get. But it's actually good. But anyways, I came here and I did my little online shopping as soon as I got here to just, you know, deliver some groceries. And I was like, nah, what I get. Well, I guess I get some peanut butter. Because you never know.
Yeah.
So yeah. I guess it's just one of those things that you just kind of grow up.
Right.
I got my kids to finally like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but it was tough.
Oh, yeah.
Because they don't really grow up with it. They have Nutella.
True, which is 1,000%
like
better.
Pure candy, yeah.
But yeah. Do you think that they have any urge to live here?
oh, they're so little and everything. They can do whatever they want. I don't know.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah.
They
can.
Well, I mean, look, they've got both passports to do whatever they want. They live anywhere they want in Europe or in America, no problem.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
You know, they can work, they can live.
Gotcha. Yeah. So one of the other reasons why I wanted you to come here is because I'm trying to go to Italy at some point next year.
Yeah. I got a business for that, too. It's called unlockedrome.com.
Wait, really?
For real. So we just did a big project in Sicily.
A lot of things.
I got too many hats, yeah.
Yeah, a lot.
I'm just the face man. I don't actually do anything. I'll pass you on to somebody
else.
Hashtag
conversation for conservation.
Yeah, exactly. No. I can help you. No, I did a couple things this summer in Sicily. That was travel-related stuff. And it's awesome because you want people to come and you want them to have an exceptional experience, an authentic experience. Uh-huh. And there's tons of stuff that you could do that I would just go, what? No, don't do that. You shouldn't have done that. So it just depends.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are just so many ways to do it. You know, even like I said, just sitting yourself in a piazza, just trying to drink in literally a city is just a great way to, you know, just slow down that pace. Because I know that there are so many things going on in your mind and you haven't been there before, but you're on vacation or you're on a honeymoon or, you know, whatever. And then, you know, it just kind of slips away from you. So if you really have that luxury to be in a place or go to Matera or talking about, you know, one of these places, then just give it a little bit of time.
Right.
You know, have that aperitivo, you know, in the afternoon. Have that little drink. The Italians don't really drink a lot. So, but they will have aperitivo.
Oh, they don't?
No, they don't. So they drink. I mean, you might drink wine every day, fine. But they don't drink.
Do people drink limoncello?
At the end of a meal, a particular kind of meal, you can have limoncello.
Because I feel like it was sold at every tourist shop.
Well, they're kind of pushing that stuff. And then in the end, every tourist and everyone else has one limoncello story where somebody was dancing on the tabletops.
Yeah.
But limoncello is great. And of course, you want to get a good limoncello. Uh-huh. So I recommend, Sicily, of course, or Amalfi Coast. I mean, they've got it's all about the lemons.
Gotcha.
So those are the
what
two
great. Do you and Italians in general think about Venice?
I mean, Venice is tough. I mean, because it's a small place and it's just, you know, inundated with tourists. I mean, this is the whole thing about heritage preservation. And why did the city allow all those monstrous cruise ships to come in doing damage and so forth? So I think they've got a lot to do to preserve that. But I mean, it's a joy. It's a literal joy going to Venice. And then my wife, she was a fellow at the Guggenheim in the years past. So she lived in and she worked in the Biennale. So she lived there. So going, you know, and we know locals. So it's like anywhere you can go in Italy. I mean, I usually know someone who's local.
Sure.
Or a friend or something, or a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's always like, just gravitate towards the locals. They will not steer you wrong.
Yeah.
And even in Venice, you know, you can have, you know, authentic experiences and go to certain places and so on and so forth. But it's just kind of a madhouse though, because there's small streets, no cars, and a lot of people walking around. So you can't really avoid that.
Yeah. It's like many places in Italy. It was so beautiful, but it felt that way. It felt like that seems like where most of their economy is based off of.
A lot of
visitors.
It's Venice, Florence, and Rome are the big ones. And then sometimes something spikes. So about not even 20 years ago, it was big. Everyone was talking about Cinque Terre.
Cinque
Terre. Right?
Yeah.
But now, so you're kind of looking around, I think Matera is going to get a lot of attention, you know, and that's good because it's a great place and it's well-maintained and so forth. And I think another place that's getting, I see it kind of, I just feel it in the conversations and the experience. I think Sicily's a big island.
Right.
No, you can drive from Palermo to Catania in about 2.5 hours.
Oh, really?
But it's still a big island per se. I mean, because Italy has tons of small islands too. So this is a biggish island. Of course, you see it there, and they have their own mentality. So there, you're definitely Sicilian first, and it's one of the few. I think there are 4 or 5 autonomous regions.
Kind of like Texas.
Yeah. No, but definitely, they do feel to be Sicilian. You're Sicilian first for sure. And just so much great history because, like I was saying before, Sicily was invaded in 827 by the Arabs, and they took over the entire island and dominated it for 200 years until the Normans came, these redheads and everything, came down and liberated it. So the idea, though, is that you've got a layer of history there that you have in Spain, you have in North Africa, right? But you don't have it from the rest of Europe. But you have it in Sicily, so it's great. You don't have that in the rest of Italy, so it's just a neat layer to experience. And they're the ones who brought. Okay, what do you think about Sicilian food? What do you think about Italian food? The Arabs brought pistachios. They brought almonds. They brought lemons. They brought oranges. So, I mean, just they brought so much. But, you know, they heavily influenced the food.
Right.
That we, you know, oh, the blood oranges of Sicily. Yeah, well, guess where they came from?
Came from somewhere else.
So, exactly. So that's just neat to see that history.
That's pretty cool. Is it hard to get there from, like, how long's the flight?
Flight is less than an hour from Rome.
Oh, yeah, that's
easy.
Nothing.
And you can do the drive. I mean, it's a fun drive. Wow.
Do you think that places like Cinque Terre have become so popular because of the internet?
The reason for Cinque Terre is very interesting. It kind of fell out of favor. And then this guy, who I met once and did some consulting for, this guy named Rick Steves.
Oh, yes.
He put Vernazza on the cover of his book, and bam. So then I was there afterwards a couple years, and, like, you know, Bruce Willis would go and get gelato at this.
And for anyone who doesn't know, it's like five towns.
Five little towns built on these cliffs where it's really beautiful, connected
colorful
by.
Colorful houses.
Nice trekking that you do from town to town.
Yeah.
Take a local train. You definitely don't have a car. And it just, you know, just, I mean, I guess it's a little faded now in the sense that it's not as hot as it used to be. But basically, like, I talked to all the locals because I was hanging out there for a little bit. And they were like, man, you know, it's just been a boon with the tourism, but then it kind of wrecks your normal life. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you hate it, but you like it. And this isn't anywhere that booms with tourism. It's going to have a profound effect. It's going to bring in money, but then it's going to maybe that little local business now fails. But this one over here that does this, it grows. And then, you know, you're changing your cuisine for the tourist that's coming in. So they're all negative aspects of that as well as the positive. But, you know, it's all about trying to preserve your identity as it continues to evolve. But, you know, there's just so much history there, you don't want it to get damaged irreparably.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a great place to visit, of course.
Yeah. When I went there, it was, I think I went there in 2011. It was great. Yeah. I enjoyed the hiking.
Yeah.
Which I thought, you know, just getting some physical activity.
Yeah,
I like that.
Exactly.
But Matera.
Yeah.
Keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, the Matera to keep an eye out for. And there is a huge ravine that really separates the city, kind of isolates it from these other cliffs where there are a lot of other churches and sites. So you can walk down the ravine, up the ravine. It's like they're mini Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely emphasis on mini. It probably takes you 40 minutes to walk down and 40 minutes to walk up. But it's worth doing that sort of thing to explore, to hike around. And it's like one of the greatest things you can do in that town is just, you know, get a little lost and go out and, you know, down the ravine.
I was reading this article, actually, that you tweeted. And it was about someone from Business Insider.
Yeah.
Was
the millennial.
Yeah. And basically she, like, travels for work and she wrote about all these places that seemed like, you know, other people she knew had probably had been there and were like, as advertised on social media, I had this life-changing experience. I found myself. It was amazing. And she wrote and posted all these pictures of everywhere she went, these major places she wanted to see.
The truth.
Like, anywhere you went, it was just crowded with people, is totally, it just kind of made me laugh.
Yeah, that's tough.
In any place that
you
visit.
That's the reality. But I mean, I think some of those sites too, some of those sites were in China and they were just huge, sheer, massive numbers of people. Chinese tourists, so just massive, right?
But just tons of
people. But the reality is, a Rome, a Venice, or whatever, as the rest of the world is becoming mobile, there's more wealth and so forth. The sheer impact from China and India alone, affecting like Italy, I think we're going up 6% in tourism just from them alone.
Oh wow!
So it's just you're always going to have more tourists coming to all these places, which are finite and small, and you can imagine what the end result's going to be 10, 20 years from now.
Right, which is why we need to preserve.
And cities have to be smart about we have this many people, but now it's going to triple in the next, 30 years. How are we going to accommodate them?
Yeah.
They got to get really serious really fast. They got to start developing some real infrastructure if they haven't already. Otherwise, it's going to be a train wreck. You know, it's going to be bad. So I think that, you know, the conservation part has to be key in that, because the sheer numbers will just, you know, destroy things. You might have to close off things. You might have to change the paths that people go on. You got to give them alternatives. One of the best things you can do is, you know, like you mentioned Machu Picchu, right? Machu Picchu. But then there's another site, which now the Peruvian government is saying, this is the other Machu Picchu where nobody goes.
Yeah, like.
And they actually, I just talked to someone at Getty Conservation who went there and said it's phenomenal. They did a great job. And one of the best things they do is you come in, there's a whole center to teach you and give you the history, da, 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 da. Then you walk 20 minutes to the site.
Wow.
So you don't even, so the site's not even being impacted by the tourist facilities and the food right. or the bathrooms or whatever. So it's like, you know, and it's that kind of thing that I think that's smart. And I think you need to celebrate that sort of stuff. And me too, I'll tell people, oh, you're coming to Rome, but don't forget that you can go here, here, and here, and here.
Right.
You know, I mean, but the thing is, like my brother's visited me so many times, brought his family. He popped over. He went to a Pearl Jam concert. He said, if Pearl Jam, he said, if Pearl Jam ever comes back to Rome, had been
that's
like 20
awesome.
Years. He's like, I'm coming.
Yeah.
So he came over. And then I said, what do you want to do? We can do anything you want. Got my scooter. We'll zip around. He goes, let's go to the Colosseum. He's like, you want to go to the Colosseum? He's like, I want to see the Colosseum.
That's like the Hollywood sign here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we had to go in. We went in and all this stuff. And you can go to the top tier now, get a special ticket and all that sort of stuff. And it's just like, it just, that kind of brings it home to me that here's a person, intelligent, educated, you know, and so on. He's actually traveled quite a bit around the world. But he's like, you know what? I want to see this.
Mm-hmm.
And it just means that it is a visceral thing. You really feel like just something that you got to see. And
totally.
So then you've got to those people, the authorities, the Vatican, that does a good job. You need to accommodate. You need to come up with new solutions. I mean, I bet you one day, like the Vatican will be like, if they want, it could be 24/7. The thing is nobody wants to work in the middle of the night.
Right.
That's the problem, you see.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
if you actually say, look, to accommodate all these people, you can go to Sistine Chapel 2 in the morning. I don't go.
Oh, I'm game.
Because there's nobody
yeah.
there,
yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So they open on Friday evenings, which is great. And I'm like, why isn't it, it's only in the summer, but why don't they do every night during the summer to accommodate that, you know, it's cooler, it's there, so less people. I don't know.
Yeah.
Actually, I just met the museum director. Is a first woman museum director. She's very nice. I'm going to ask her.
Yeah.
Next time I see her.
Late nights at the Vatican.
No, because they do it. They do it, and it's very successful. And that's the kind of thing you need, new solutions. And sometimes it's not so hard.
You should work for the Rome Tourism Board.
I did some consulting with them.
Yeah.
But they need more teeth. Because some consulting, and they're great. They're wonderful. But, you know, some cities, maybe Barcelona, you know, some cities have more teeth, more oomph, more resources.
Right.
And I think if you want your tourism board to be really successful, then you got to put the resources behind them. I don't think Rome, they need more, you know.
Gotcha.
To affect real change. But, you know, if you know anything about Rome, it's always complicated. Okay. Many,
lots of complicated.
But I mean, in the end, any city here, right? Anything's complicated. But Rome, I'm telling you,
complicated. Los Angeles feels that way.
Yeah, come to Rome.
Driving on the freeway.
Come to Rome and try to get a business opened or, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure. Problems.
Tough. But I mean, realistically speaking, I mean, I do a lot of stuff online and the payments and the this and the that. And I mean, I know my way around. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's not. But generally speaking, once you enter into the bureaucracy of, it's phenomenal. It's great, but you know, it's not easy.
Yeah, not always.
Yeah.
Not always.
Hurry up and wait. Hurry up
easy.
And wait.
Yeah. So, before you get out of here, is there any places in Southern California you like? If you have some free time, you want to go to or
I
check
got a
out?
Friend, I got a friend who's like, tell me to see some of the missionaries.
Oh.
Yeah, I've been to one, but a friend of mine. I can't remember what the town is. It's just like not even an hour away south of L.A. But I mean, so I've got some.
Wait, south, you said?
Yeah. I can't remember which mission it is. But anyways, he's got one targeted for me. He's like, you have to come here. I'm like, okay.
San Juan Capistrano?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, San Juan Cap.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So I got to go there.
Yeah.
No, I'm going there.
Yeah.
Because and so I want to get the local flavor and the local history. And obviously, you know, got a lot of friends here, so. You know, a lot of indications on where to go and
yeah.
eat.
Are you going to go? Are you going to go anywhere else in the U.S. just while you're over here?
I'm going to give a talk on Friday at Cal Poly.
Oh, nice.
I'm going to give a talk at NYU on November 5th, and I think I'll see if I can give a talk here, a public talk. When I'm in, definitely USC. I'm giving a talk.
Oh, nice.
Because we have a summer program with USC.
Yeah, the Trojans.
The Trojans. They have a Colosseum, right? That's their.
They do.
So there you go.
It's.
But they should be like the Romans, not the Trojans. Got a Colosseum, they should be.
Yeah.
Right? Am I right?
Yeah. Isn't that
the Trojans
like Athens?
Like, yeah. Well, the Trojans are the big enemies of the Athenians.
Oh, right.
Just see episode on Athens that I did on ancient.
How do you?
We covered the Athenians and the. Yeah.
That's on what, PBS?
PBS.
How do you get it? How do you get PBS?
You can
get it. Is it on demand?
On demand. Oh, just okay. Go to the website or yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm into it. I'm watching it.
And if you can always just ping me at any of these social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. It's Darius Aria Diggs.
D-I-G-S. Diggs.
Because I dig history.
Well, that's awesome. This is great. This is Thank you.
The best podcast ever.
Ever.
You're going to retire now, right?
And scene. Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you know someone who's planning to visit Italy or is, you know, just into history, share this episode with them. Personal recommendations help spread the word. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe to Olympic and Bundy. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all those places. Once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thanks very much for listening.